Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, October 1st, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everybody. We're almost there. One more day to crawl into the stretch. It is 52 degrees and cloudy and chilly here in upstate New York. Feels like fall, just like the flipping of the switch as soon as we hit it on the calendar. Fall is definitely here. The trees are starting to change. My tomatoes are starting to go all yellow. Just depressing because my tomatoes are the one vegetable that did well this year. I'm going to miss having all kinds of fresh, big honking tomatoes. So, where do we leave off yesterday? I don't think we had that much of a grand plan. We just looked at items. But we titled the show yesterday, Brain Implants, Behavior Monitoring, and Smart Pills. And yeah, we discovered there was some pretty crazy stuff that they are experimenting with. I mean, Smart Pills, it's not going to be too long before we have the good old Regina Duggan superpowers that will be provided to us through a swallowable device. And I mean, it's not going to have to be a swallowable device eventually, but we did find out in our research at how wonderfully the mucosa lining in your small intestine allowed your body to absorb anything that they were putting into you. Now, interesting, because I just loaded everything up on a freshly rebooted computer and I can't even open the description on the YouTube video. Oh, is it going to be one of these mornings? This is a freshly rebooted computer too. So anyway, I don't know. I've been super, super, super busy working on all kinds of projects with different groups that we're trying to get a bunch of stuff launched here. So again, I pulled another late one, and I don't have any grand connecting dot points that we're going to make this week because nothing's really interested me. Though the one thing that I did see that I thought was super cooler than cool, and it was Sovereign Tech posted it last night. And then I dug into it and watched the video and stuff, and it was pretty awesome. LG Electronics, I think it was today. And again, you know, don't get sucked in by your devices, but I could still like to sit at a distance on the sideline and watch the pretty pictures. But LG Electronics is releasing a second generation of their smartwatch, I guess you would call it. I don't know if there's a whole term for this new wearable technology, but it's coming. First of all, I found out digging into this, there's a whole new operating system for wearable computing. I don't know if you knew this, but it came out the end of last year, and it's called Android Wear. But what I've discovered is that Android Wear is just kind of a skinnied down version of Android, so it's like a mobile. And a lot of our applications that we already can use on our cell phone, they're just recompiling so you can download from the Google Store and use it on your wearable computer. So anyway, this new LG watch, what was kind of slick about it is that it looked just like an old school analog watch. It was a nice looking one. It had a barometer and a GPS and all this other crap on it with analog dials. But when you touched it, it became like a touch screen. And in this newest version, like, people were complaining. I had a friend who really, really wanted one of these, so we dug into them, and people were complaining because the first generation of these watches connected via Bluetooth to your cell phone. So your watch itself wasn't the cell phone, but you could make calls on it as long as you were within proximity of your cell phone. Well, this new version of this LG watch that's being announced today literally has all of the antennas integrated into it, so it does 4G, 3G, wireless, Bluetooth, and Wi-Fi. And I was thinking to myself, from the perspective of being a dumb end user consumer and watching this video that's trying to sell it to me, how mobile you could be, going to the gym, you're working out, you're running on the track, you're wall rock climbing, and you can get your calls and your messages and everything all at once. And I was like, wow, that's like pretty damn slick, because you don't even have to worry about carrying your cell phone. You're not going to lose it. It's always going to be in your arm. But understanding what we understand about how all these signals are wavelengths, they're energy. All that passes through your body that affects all your cells. That causes you to have cellular damage. And we stand in a room full of waves already. I mean, I don't know about you, but I never put a cell phone against my head. Well, what's going to happen? We're all going to end up with wrist cancer as we're wearing this wearable 4G 24/7 on your wrist. I mean, doesn't sound like a good idea to me. And of course, plausible deniability. By the time he ends up with arm cancer, I don't know, can you even get arm cancer? By the time you end up with arm cancer, it's going to be 20 years down the line. How are you ever going to prove that it was your smartwatch? Anyway, keep an eye out for that. I don't even remember the name of it, but it looks like Verizon and AT&T are probably going to carry them because they carry the old version currently. It's pretty slick looking, and like I said, it looks like an old school analog round watch, and it can do everything. Oh, back to the operating system, and then I'm going to move on. This Android Wear operating system, they literally can integrate any of the applications, it looks like, now. So I just saw they even launched Skype for it. So you could have Skype on your little cell phone, Get Smart cell phone wristwatch. If anyone remembers that show from the 70s, Get Smart. It's funny, it's called the smartwatch. So I don't know. That was kind of the one thing that caught my attention last night, at least from a dangling carrot-ish perspective. I was like, wow. If I was allowed to like technology anymore, I'd want one of those. Oh, another thing, actually, I was going to talk about some wavelengthy stuff today, and there was a story out of Machine Like Us called The Light Transfer Orb, and it was a pretty interesting story that came out back at the beginning of September about them being able to use photons. And I mean, they already are when you use fiber. It no longer is zeros and, well, I mean, it is zeros and ones, but it's no longer electrical signals sending zeros and ones. When you use fiber optics, it now is literally light that is sending the zeros and ones, but it's doing it by making it dark and light, right? Off and on. That's all we have. But, you know, once we move into the world of quantum computing, everything changes. But anyway, there was this story about, in the future, we're going to be receiving our information from a light orb, which was really bizarre looking. Of course, it was just like this white orb with light coming out of it that you could like touch and then get your information out of. But I was going to read that today, and I clicked it, and it says, you are not authorized to access this page on Machines Like Us. But it was titled Magic Sphere Information Transfer. And you know what? Wait a minute. Hold on. Let's see. We'll see if someone else has it. Magic Sphere Information. What was it? It's early still. Transfer. Ask me if I'm awake today. Not really, but I fake it well. Oh, well, here, looky. Nanowork Magazine and Science Daily have a story on it. So let's do it. This was from the beginning of September, but it was a pretty freaky, weird story. Here we go. Photon-based rather than electron-based computers? Yes! The magic sphere is here for your information transfer. Makes me think of like one of those 1970s, you know, coming up to Christmas commercials with the new fangled toys coming out. I was always into the technology toys. Remember Simon? Do, 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 do. The memory toy and Merlin. They were all cool. Here's the new one, the magic sphere, except this looks like something out of a Doctor Who episode with the Ood, those things that look like Cthulhu's holding the white orbs in their hands. It says, in several years, and then they answer this, or maybe in one or two decades. I don't think it's going to be one or two decades for any of this stuff. But you gotta love the way this starts out. In several years, maybe in one or two decades, but maybe sooner or never. Come on. One of the existing problems will be solved in an original way. Our computers, nano antennas, and other kinds of equipment will operate on the base of photons rather than electrons. Even now, we are practically prepared to accomplish the switch, and they really are getting very far on this. I mean, I subscribe to all of these, even IEEE. I mean, anybody who who's on Facebook or Twitter, you should look up, like, Science Daily is a good one, phys.org, the IEEE Spectrum, which is your electrical engineers. Those are three really good publications. Science Alert, though they don't do... They do more bioscience as opposed to technology science. But they're really, I mean, a lot of stuff is coming with quantum. But what's really scary is what's coming as fast as quantum is some of these nanomaterials for the next generation, self-repairing this, that, and the other thing. And I actually have a video about NASA's self-repairing materials. We'll look at that. But our physical reality is not going to be like it is today here in a few years at all. Can you imagine having a self-repairing car? I mean, they've been working on that for a long time. Where if you get a dent, like it literally the dent will pop itself out. If you want to change the color of your car, there's this nano paint that we were reading about the one night. Like you literally can change the color of your car on the fly. Imagine, I mean, I am so anti-technology, but at times, I gotta tell you, I mean, I freely admitted this, I have been a techno freak my entire life, science fiction, bring it on, because I love this stuff, but it's just gotten to the point where we are literally at the brink of destruction, that we could easily push the wrong button, have one wrong gene slice, and whoops, Johnny's got two heads, you know? So it's very frightening to me in the fact that we have illustrated time and time and time and time and time again that none of these government agencies have any fucking clue what's going on. They're bumping into each other. And I mean, they might have a clue, but it absolutely isn't a clue that's keeping you and me safe. It's a clue that has some evil plan behind it or just complete nincompoopness. But it is not the type of clue that I would expect out of people handling technology that could destroy the world if you had a little accident. And I mean, yeah, let's go back to even nuclear weapons and whatever. It's not like it hasn't existed, but I just can't get over the complete and utter lack of responsibility that should be required by somebody in a position such as that. And the fact that nobody is watching the store, there is no grand plan, this is just willy-nilly in every corner. I mean, anybody's ever worked in corporate America, and especially if you've been in management, that's called recipe for disaster. So, all right, you need to have control of the store. You know, there needs to be standards, and everyone needs to follow them. Otherwise, shit falls apart. All right, let's read this. Anyway, back to the magic sphere. Even now, we are practically prepared to accomplish the switch, and that is moving from a base of photons to that, or yeah, from to a base of photons from electrons. If it happens, the spheres studied by an international group of Russian, French, and Spanish scientists will definitely be able to become one of the elementary components of new photonic devices. And the results of the study were published in the latest issue of Scientific Reports, which is part of the Nature Publishing Group. The potentialities of the conventional electronic computers are going to be exhausted. And, you know, they say now that, oh, even though they thought that we were going to hit that brink of Moore's Law, that they think now they've just broke some barrier with making things even more microscopically small. And just know now with nanotech running hog wild, I don't think they're going to have much of an issue. And way, way, way back when, we had read about those brand new transistors that they made so small, it was like the head of the tip of a pin or something, that had more computing power than your desktop machine. You know, and I'd imagine that that would be for stuff like smart dust or, you know, some sort of monitoring application in a very, very small device, you know, electronics. But the scary thing is once we get computing power at such a micro scale that is like nothing we've ever seen before. And then think about it. They start linking those together, regardless if they're little nanobots or just nanomaterials, and they start linking all those together. I mean, think about the future technologies. You could have a sheet, just a sheet of these supercomputers instead of a huge complex in the middle of the desert, NSA. That requires like 6 billion gallons of water or some insanity to cool. Get this little nano sheet of supercomputing device. It's just sometimes, even with all the years that I've been in technology, it is really difficult for me to wrap my head around what we are literally on the brink of. Anyway, so back to this. Potentialities of conventional electronic computers are going to be exhausted. And during the last four decades, Moore's Law, there we go, ding, according to which computers' processor speed doubles every 18 months, was fulfilled due to the increasing of the operating frequency of a single processor. But now, the same result is reached by means of the parallel computing. We have a dual-core processor as well as quad-core. And I just saw something the other day with whatever this new technology was that they came out with. They had some insanity, like, and I don't even want to spit out numbers because honestly, I don't remember, but I remember going, holy crap, what? 32, 87, 8, 90. I don't know. It was some huge number. I mean, back in the day when I was doing server engineering, oh, probably was late 90s at a corporate level. So, I mean, we were selling clustered cloud computing back in those days, except they didn't call it cloud computing because that term didn't exist yet. But pretty much what it was, where you had multiple high-end servers that you connected together with a heartbeat link and they all worked as one big unit. I mean, we were building, that was the beginning of supercomputers. And in these big honking servers, and we're talking, you know, HP, Compaq, IBM, they were the three biggies, you would have the ability to do, like, I remember the first dual processor units, then the four-way came out, then the eight-way. I don't know if I ever worked on a 16-way, but I most certainly configured tons of 2, 4, and 8-way servers where you would have like 8 CPUs in a unit. And that was massive. But do you know how big those processors were? And do you know how much they cost? I mean, we were looking at, in those days, like $10,000 a processor. You know, and then you had the memory. You could scale that memory up. And there was not any type of tera anything in those days. It was gigabit. If you could reach gigabit, you were shelling out from your pocket. And I'm trying to remember, like, what a gigabit chip would be on a server price-wise. I mean, it's so low now, but back in those days, memory was a commodity. They literally traded memory at a broker. There is a memory brokerage house, and I don't know if they do it anymore because once China got into the game of producing memory, memory prices just dropped out of the bottom. But back in those days, it was, you know, for one of those big honking chips, I mean, I would say it was like when things started to get affordable, it was like $1 a meg. So when you had a gigabit chip, a gigabyte of memory, it would have been like $1,000, but that was already after stuff normalized. Before that, though, you know, $2,000-$3,000. And then if you had 8 gig in your machine, they were very, very expensive endeavors. So anyway, I just went off on the course. So there is some new technology that is like literally a supercomputer on a chip that I was just reading about the other day in one of these. It might have been in the IEEE. that they're working on releasing here, where, you know, you don't need to plug in four separate CPUs. You know, when they have quad computing in one CPU that you can get on a desktop. And I mean, just look at how short of a time that is. Let's say I started in tech in 95 and I was a technician until 99. Thinking, so in that 4 years, and then I went into network engineering, but that was systems engineering. Just from 95 to 99, and here we are now 20 years later, and we have gone from something that maybe would have cost you $100,000 to load that server up, and now you got it on your desktop for, I mean, if you had a loaded machine, still might cost you $500, $800, let's say $1,000, sub $1,000 PC, you know, more of a professional workstation. But look at the delta. And that's just in 20 years. That's why I'm scared. When I see all this stuff coming, our world is going to be completely alien to us in the next 20 years for certain. But I'm predicting even in the next 10. And this is just going to slip in under the doormat without us noticing. Anyway, it says now the same result is reached by means of parallel computing. We have dual core processors as well as quad core. And like I said, there are like 32 cores, 64 cores, whatever is coming. And it means that single core processors are not able to cope with the computational speed demanded. And that's true. Try taking one of your old machines from 2-3 years ago. And I mean, I have stuff. I have 10-year-old computers running here. I'm broadcasting on a 10-year-old machine now. But I haven't updated anything. It's not like I could take the newest Photoshop or anything and put it on that machine. That machine is like locked in time for the software it has on it. It says, moreover, it is not possible to increase the speed anymore because modern computers' processor operating frequency is close to the theoretical limit. The process of multiplying the number of cores is also not endless, but by all accounts, it will soon come to an end. That's why plenty of research teams all around the world are now working on the creation of super fast optical systems, which would be able to replace the electronic computer. On one hand, such systems should be as small as possible, and on the other hand, optical radiation has its own scale. The wavelength, which is in the visible range of the spectrum, is about 0.5 micrometers, and this scale is too big to be implemented in modern electronic devices with ultra-dense arrangements of elements. In order to compete with such electronic devices, I needed some coffee. Optical systems should work on scales much shorter than the wavelengths, and these problems fall within the domain of the modern discipline called sub-wavelength optics. Now, what's cool about that, too, is way back in the day, we did fiber, oh, I would say beginning of the 2000s is really when fiber heated up and all the municipalities had money to trench. When they were redoing roads, they were doing downtown. Like, that was a huge thing. Just about every municipality in America trenched their downtown and laid fiber, even if the equipment didn't exist yet, because it really didn't back in those days. But everybody laid fiber. That was the promise. That was the future. And they had funding. They had sprinkle funding. I don't know if there were grants or whatever. But it came to a point back when I then started doing the network engineering. That was the big thing. The big thing was merging the networks of the old school phone network that was tied to your landlines and the newfangled data network that was tied to the internet. They used to be two totally separate networks. So the big promise was to tie those all together over one network and then to get super fast speeds between your locations. And they typically, in a city or some place where you were fortunate enough to have fiber in the ground, you would tie it to fiber. And fiber was very expensive. But there was a lot of potential. So one of the ways that we would be able to boost the signal, not just even the signal, the throughput from point A to point B. So let's say we were doing it downtown and we had the main building where the mayor lived, and then maybe we had the main building where security and the police were, and then we had the main building where like all the billing was. I don't know. You know, every city has, you know, their couple main buildings that they do stuff with, and typically that's how they design them. You put three hubs, so anyone goes down, and you have them in a ring, and anyone goes down, you always got another route to get to the information. But the way you would boost the bandwidth, instead of just having one single pipe in fiber, so one pipe that maybe you were doing gigabit over, there's something called wave division multiplexing. And I remember when I discovered wave division multiplexing. And I mean, it's pretty complicated to understand the actual science behind it, but it does exactly what you think it would do. It takes the wavelengths of light and it splits them out into their separate wavelengths and sends data down each of those wavelengths. So instead of just having one pipe that you can send maybe a gig per second data, now all of a sudden, if you split it into eight wavelengths of light, poof, you got 8 gig of data all in a burst. And what's interesting about that is actually I saw in some of the new solar technology, you know, they've been poo-pooing solar forever because, well, it's not really efficient and it wastes a lot of the energy and blah, blah, blah. Well, the reason why it didn't used to be efficient is because it was only grabbing one wavelength of light, except that light is a spectrum. It exists in all different energy waves and wavelengths. And so some of these new solar panels that I saw that are these high-capacity ones, that's exactly what they're doing. They're taking – we get full-spectrum light from the sun. So they are taking the sun and they're breaking it out into all of its separate wavelengths and sucking energy out of all those. So anyway, I don't know why I dug into that, but I just wanted to explain to you, we're kind of talking about electrons versus photons. And it's really interesting because they make it sound like this is newfangled technology. This was mid-90s, and I mean, we were selling fiber back then, and early 2000s, it was already being implemented. And that wave division multiplexing, we were doing that already. But it looks like they found a new way now. Collective oscillations. Says these problems fall within the domain of modern discipline called subwavelength optics. And the aim of subwavelength optics is to manipulate with electromagnetic radiation on scales shorter than its wavelength. In other words, to do things which were considered as conceptually impossible in the traditional optics of lenses and mirrors. And yeah, wave division multiplexing does not use lenses and mirrors. You're doing some sort of manipulation and splitting the wavelengths of light. I don't know how much more we are going to read of this. I mean, it was pretty interesting, but this goes on and on and on and on and on. So what I want to find out about is the magic light sphere. So let's go down to the end. That's usually a good way to do it. Oh my God, this is the one problem with like these technical publications is that they are so dry and they don't have a little markety punchline to get someone to really read it. You got to dig in. But here, let's read this. Bearing in mind practical applications of the obtained results, it is important to stress that the fabrication technique of such a nanosphere for manipulation of optical and near-infrared radiation is rather cheap and simple. It does not require any exotic, expensive, and/or sophisticated equipment. And besides, the optical computers, which nowadays yet stay in the sphere of virtual reality, but they're working on it. Trust me, optical computers, they are definitely working on. I tend to publish any new research that they find on that where they think, actually, on my Facebook page, I just posted something the other day. They were able to store information in a photon. I don't know. My computer might not go there. It doesn't require any exotic, expensive materials and or sophisticated equipment. And besides the optical computer, nanoscale spheres described in the paper by Tribolsky, who's the guy who's doing this research, and co-authors, can be used in a wide range of different fields. telecommunication systems, ding ding. Recording, processing, and storing of information, ding ding. Diagnosis and treatments of different diseases, as well as cancer, etc. So there you go. It kind of brings all these different worlds together. Even the ability to diagnose cancer, wouldn't you know it? Everything comes down to diagnosing cancer. Oh, here we go. This, yeah, I did post this the other day. Light-based memory chip. Light-based memory chip is the first to permanently store data. We're going to store data with light, guys. And this really is, like, pretty amazing. It's so science fiction-y, but it's pretty amazing. Like, who would ever thought? I mean, I remember back in the 90s, we used to talk about being able to store information in crystals. And Seagate Electronics, they make hard drives. They were actually working on that research for a very long time. And I don't know whatever happened to that, but they wanted to get away from platters on a hard drive because it's so volatile. You drop your hard drive and those platters crash, you're done. They wanted to get into something that was more solid state. I don't know if anyone's looked at solid state memory, but it's still pretty expensive. Stuff like flash. And I mean, if you're looking at trying to get a couple terabytes of solid state memory, first of all, I don't think it really exists. There might be a few that you might see out there, but if they do exist, you're talking thousands of dollars. I mean, they're not even with a toe in the field of the mainstream. They're still at that really super high end, but I mean, this light transfer photon, it's light, man. There's not even really any matter involved. It's all energy now. It's so hard to wrap. Even, like I said, just for someone who's done this for so many years, this is a whole paradigm shift. We're not talking circuits and charges anymore. We're talking light and wavelengths. Just different frequencies of things. It's just messed up. All right, we'll look at this quick. I don't know. I guess this is a technology show today. Today's electronic computer chips work at blazing speeds, but an alternate version that stores, manipulates, and moves data with photons of light instead of electrons would make today's chips look like proverbial horses and buggies. And now one team of researchers reports that it has created the very first permanent optical memory on a chip, a critical step in that direction. Remember, light travels at 186,000 miles per second. That's pretty fast stuff. I am very positive about the work, says Venerio Pernuni, a laser physicist at the Institute of Photonic Sciences in Barcelona, Spain, who was not involved in the research. It is a great demonstration of a new concept. And you know, come to think of it, that probably is how stuff like that wave division multiplexing works. Though back in those days, the laser technology still wasn't very advanced. But now, I mean, you can have lasers at all kinds of different frequencies. Set them at different nanometer scales, and you can shoot, you know, 1,000 lasers all down one pipe, all in different frequencies, and nothing crosses over. Interest in so-called photonic chips goes back decades. See, told you. And it's easy to see why. When electrons move through the basic parts of a computer chip, logic circuits that manipulate data, memory circuits that store it, and metal wires that ferry it along, they bump into one another, slowing it down and generating heat that must be siphoned away. Oh, I didn't realize that. But yeah, electricity does create heat with the friction from the electrons. And that is not the case with photons, which, you know what, Rode? That's a point you've brought up before about light itself does not create heat. Though I guess it depends on what frequency of light. But that is not the case with photons, which travel together with no resistance and do so at, well, the speed of light. Researchers have already made photon-friendly chips with optical lines that replace metal wires and optical memory circuits. But the parts have some serious drawbacks. The memory circuits, for example, can store data only if they have a steady power supply. And when the power is turned off, poof, the data disappears. Well, that would suck now, wouldn't it? Now, researchers led by Harish Barakashan, I hate these names, Bhaskaran, a nanoengineering expert at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom, and electrical engineer Wolfram Pirnies at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Germany have hit on a solution to the disappearing memory problem using the material at the heart of rewritable CDs and DVDs. You know, that's awesome. I was just asking that the other day. You know, why don't we have, I mean, I remember when CDs came out and then DVDs and then single-layer, dual-sided, you know, and they were stacking them up. And I think it got up to like 8 gig, 8.7 gig dual-layer, dual-sided DVDs. And then you had the burnable ones. And they were just literally using lasers that then refocused its laser to access the second layer. They were different wavelengths of light that allowed you to read one and then read the other. Why have there been no advances in any of that technology? It just doesn't make sense to me because it was so promising as like a permanent storage archive medium, especially. So I'm very excited that they are using some sort of technology from that because, I mean, you don't even see usually now CD, we were talking about that the other night in chat, CD or DVD drives on a notebook anymore. Just like the way of the floppy drive, poof, it just became obsolete when we had USB. And I mean, I'm not saying that DVDs are gone, but there definitely are not improvements that I've seen. I mean, it was leaps and bounds for a while there for capacity. And I mean, I would think now with our technology, we could probably have 20 terabyte DVDs, you know, with 20 layers. I just don't understand why they didn't continue on with that technology. Maybe somebody out there knows that. Anyway, so it's using the material that's at the heart of rewritable CDs and DVDs. That material, which is abbreviated as GST, consists of a thin layer of an alloy of germanium, antimony, and tellurium. Those are all of those rare earth minerals that I think they mine out of China. But hey, don't worry about it, because I saw something the other day where they're actually going to use plants to mine rare earth minerals, where they'll get the plants to suck them all up. And they do exist all over the planet, just in smaller doses. And then they're going to dry the plants out and recover the rare earth minerals. When zapped with an intense pulse of laser light, this GST film changes its atomic structure from an ordered crystalline lattice to an amorphous jumble. And these two structures reflect light in different ways. The CDs and DVDs use this difference to store data and to read out the data stored as patterns of tiny spots with a crystalline or amorphous order. The CD or DVD drive shines a low-intensity laser light on a disc and tracks the way that the light bounces off. In their work with GST, the researchers noticed that the material affected not only how light reflects on the film, but also how much of the light is absorbed. And when a transparent material lay underneath the film, spots with a crystalline order absorb more light than did spots with an amorphous structure, which would make sense. I mean, that means you have holes in it. Next, researchers wanted to see if they could use this property to permanently store data on a chip and read it out later. And to do so, they used standard chip-making technology to outfit a chip with a silicon nitride device known as a waveguide. I don't know what that is, which contains and channels pulses of light. Oh, so maybe that's like that wave division multiplexing I was talking about, where you could take different wavelengths and channel them. And then they placed a nanoscale patch of GST atop this waveguide. And to write the data in this layer, scientists piped an intense pulse of light into the waveguide, and the high intensity of the light's electromagnetic field melted the GST, turned its crystalline atomic structure amorphous, and a second, slightly less intense pulse could then cause the material to revert back to its original crystalline structure. So there you go, read, write. When the researchers wanted to read the data, they beamed in a less intense pulse of light and measured how much light was transmitted through the waveguide. And if little light was absorbed, they knew that their data spot on the GST had an amorphous order. If more was absorbed, it meant crystalline. Okay. Anyway, so to wrap this up, photonic memories still have a long way to go if they ever hope to catch up to their electronic counterparts. At a minimum, their storage density will have to climb orders of magnitude to be competitive. But remember, I mean, we're talking about photons. I don't think there's going to be an issue here. Once they finish cracking all these codes, I mean, they did just prove that spooky action at a distance exists. I mean, they are just coming up with discoveries, leaps and bounds with physics and all this crazy stuff that had just been theory before. I don't think, like I said, it's not going to be 20 or 40 years out there. I say within the next 10 years, it's going to be a whole new brave world. Ultimately, if a more advanced photonic memory can be integrated with photonic logic and interconnections, the resulting chips have the potential to run at 50 to 100 times the speed of today's processors. I mean, when we look at AI and we look at how fast that's moving and all this supercomputing initiative, which of course is another federal initiative, an edict per Obama, and as things are getting smaller and smaller and as they're integrating them into everything, it really makes you wonder. I mean, we could, every aspect of our lives could be taken care of by some sort of computing device that, you know, augments our reality or augments our cognition, or hey, wearable clothing with computers. I mean, they're already working on that. They're already working on this whole wearable computing initiative to become part of the Internet of Things. We haven't heard that one in a while, huh? It's getting there. It absolutely is. I mean, in the types of days where they can 3D print kidneys and ears, anything is possible. Actually, speaking of the Internet of Things, I did see a story on that in regards to DARPA last night. Well, then, this is out on the federal bid site. If it loads, here we go. Good old DARPA. We got to do a DARPA story. DARPA looking for tech to protect the Internet of Things. And you and I will become an IP address on the Internet of Things here soon and in the future. And that's where these little mini swallowable computing devices could come in really handy. Hey, by the way, I also saw last night, did you know that there is a smart app that you can control your Mr. Coffee with? And the marketing commercial was just so ridiculous. They're showing this woman like sitting on a couch. She has all these guests over and she's like, ooh, she pulls out her smartphone and boop, 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 programs her coffee maker to turn on. And then in like the next scene, there's somebody just waking up in bed and they pick up their cell phone, doo, 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 and they turn their coffee on. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what a freaking lazy waste of time that is. Get your ass out of bed. Fill the water. I mean, if you want to be smart about it, do it the night before. Put the water and the coffee in. And even hit set your timer and it brews. But like, how dumb? Unless you've already done all that, which I mean, you could do without a smartphone. If you're laying in bed and you tell your coffee maker to turn on and there's no coffee and there's no water in it, you still got to get your ass out of bed. So until they get a smart app that can fill my coffee and my water. We have reservoirs sitting around so it'll auto brew without me doing anything. It was pretty useless for like $118 or something. But I thought it was still cool. But I was like, Jesus, an internet connected freaking coffee maker. That's all we need. Yeah, can you tell? I dug into technology stuff last night. I don't know. I haven't looked at it in a long time as far as computing stuff. So went down a little rabbit hole. Anyway, so this is DARPA and protecting your Internet of Things. Now, who's involved in the DARPA's Internet of Thing technology? Is good old Regina Duggan swallow a pill and get your superpowers? Oh, yes. She was a former director at DARPA who now works for Google in their Internet of Things division. Don't think there's not a connection there. The Pentagon's emerging technology agency wants to know what a device's thermal output shows about cyber intrusions. Oh, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency's Information Innovation Office, was a mouthful, plans to award tens of millions of dollars, $36 million in this first phase, for a technology that could monitor devices in the Internet of Things. And then in parentheses, it says a term that could connote anything from a high-tech washing machine to sensors in industrial factories. The DARPA program called, quote, leveraging the analog domain for security, unquote. I want to remain analog. I think that'll become my new mantra. The DARPA program called leveraging the analog domain for security intends to examine involuntary emissions from devices, which are electromagnetic, acoustic, thermal, as well as power fluctuations, to determine the software running on the device. Now, we saw a story a few months back where they were able to like hijack the information being processed on your computer just by the frequencies that your processor was making, which I still didn't understand how on earth they were doing that, but we did a whole story on it, and it sounded like they already had it all figured out. Like I said, I don't totally get how they were taking your frequency from your processor. The only thing I could figure is that they now integrate. It's been a long time since I've built a computer from scratch, but I remember seeing that Intel was integrating the 802.11 wireless radio on the processing chip itself. So it isn't a separate, we used to have to add cards at one point. It's not separate anymore. It's all integrated. So I'm assuming that they were figuring out some way to cross jump between the wireless signal that would give them access to their processor directly and then what was going on in there. But honestly, I don't know how they were really doing that. But anyway, they are intending to examine involuntary emissions. And how long will it be before they figure out how to monitor involuntary emissions from things such as your brain, which is also electromagnetic? You know, they're doing all kinds of stuff. Like yesterday, we read about a lot of the mental health stuff and monitoring and things that are going on. I don't think that's going to be too long for that either. They could like literally read your thoughts from afar. But these involuntary emissions from devices are electromagnetic, acoustical, thermal, as well as power fluctuations to determine the software running on the device. Those indicators could also tell researchers which functions the device is executing or which part of its memory it's accessing, an announcement had said. This monitoring system could be a separate device, a component within the device being monitored, or an external component and the end goal, according to DARPA, is, oh my God, here's what I told you, this is going to be the key word from now until doomsday, the algorithms. Yes, it's algorithms, tools, and devices for mapping analog emissions of digital devices. While desktop computers and servers may have many layers of protection, including hardware and software defenses, these security systems often can't be applied to mission-specific devices and devices with embedded, well, there we go, that's where the wireless is embedded on the chip, embedded computing chips because of computational cost, complexity, or other system requirements. Attackers have repeatedly demonstrated the ability to pierce protection boundaries, taking advantage of the fact that security systems are often within the same computing unit as the rest of a compromised device's software, according to DARPA. Now, DARPA is also, you know, I read one of their requests for proposal back a while ago. I don't know if it was this year or last year, but the whole Skynet, we talked about the Skynet coming online. I mean, one of the things that they are looking at is a, how would I term it, a day zero, I guess. Like I talked about this, like in antivirus software, there were a couple different ways that you can protect yourself. The old school way is that you have to keep downloading virus definitions every time your antivirus company identifies them, right? So you are at risk until a virus has been identified and then the definition downloaded so you can scan your machine and your machine can watch for it. Then there was a newfangled way of doing it. It was called Day Zero. And Day Zero basically took properties of, like general properties, let's say, of an application. So let's say application ABC typically only should have rights to this level of memory access. It shouldn't be able to get to the root of your operating system, let's say. And that would be generally across the board, except for software like antivirus that actually touches the core of your computing memory. And so anytime that this antivirus software would see any anomalous behavior, i.e. something trying to access a memory area that it doesn't have rights to, that would flag an alert. Doesn't know if it's good or bad. It just tells you anomalous behavior is happening. Here is an alert. Take a look at it and decide if you want us to do something about it and block it or if you want to let it go. And honestly, that worked pretty cool. That was done in software. And then they also did it in hardware for the higher end stuff. That would be on like big ass honking core routers. They actually had cards that went in and scanned all your traffic looking for anomalous behavior. And then you had endpoint software on each of your remote computers that would be communicating with that card. And then you could download software updates and push them out to all the remotes. But it worked pretty well. Day zero intrusion, they called it intrusion detection and protection. Day zero intrusion protection worked pretty well, but now hackers have gotten, quote unquote, hackers. I still don't think all these hackers out there, I mean, maybe in Russia and China, yes. Russian hackers have been legendary since my days as a tech. You know, and I'm sure that they've gotten more sophisticated. They make lots of money that way. There's large organized crime hacking institutions in places such as Russia. But they found ways to like get in back doors. All your applications have holes and do all kinds of crazy stuff. So DARPA steps up and says, hey, since we have all this hacking now that's happening on a grand scale, and wow, look at all the high profile places that have been hit over the last year, conveniently, wink. So now we have to come up with a brand new way to protect the entire national infrastructure of networks. It's not just now the federal networks. It's the infrastructure of networks. And we're going to partner, according to Obama's executive order, we're partnering now corporations and the government to all work together to keep us safe and secure. So DARPA is now looking for an intrusion detection and protection software that does something like Day Zero, where it detects anomalous behavior, but it also destroys and launches counterattacks. This is the type of stuff that they're looking at. So it's interesting now that they're also now digging in. So that was perimeter-wide. Now they're digging into tools that can also get in and sniff the hardware and get information off of, what were they calling it? The analog signals off your digital. All right, anyway. Interested teams should explain their plans to navigate the trade-off between monitoring systems' accuracy and the distance from the device to be monitored, and also describe if the technology can operate even in noisy environments, among other factors. I mean, this sounds like, they make it sound like it's a security tool, but this sounds like spy toys extraordinaire to me. You could drive down the street and be sucking all the data off your PCs just with some little device in your car. The program has three phases. First two are 18 months each, and the final phase is 12 months. And widespread use of connected devices, and this is specifically for the Internet of Things. They'll be able to monitor your coffee maker, your dishwasher, and your refrigerator. The widespread use of connected devices requires the exploration and development of cybersecurity capabilities that are conducive to these device limitations. So, I don't know. That really didn't give us any information except for the fact that DARPA is interested in your home, your future home electronics, and they're going to have their finger in that cookie jar as well. All right, we got about a minute left, so let's look at this last technology that I ran across last night. Radio frequency harvesting tech unveiled in the UK, and this is pretty slick, I gotta tell you. An energy harvesting technology that its developers say will turn ambient radio frequency waves into usable electricity to charge low power devices was unveiled in London on Wednesday. And we had talked about how, like, our entire environment, if we had a map, you would be able to see wavelengths of 10 million different devices flowing through everywhere. Well, now they have a device that'll be able to harvest that radiation, whether it be Wi-Fi, cellular, broadcast, whatever it is, and turn it into electricity so you could literally, like, charge your cell phone from the air. And if you could do that, imagine what it's doing to our bodies. And hey, I just looked at the clock and we only have like 10 seconds left. So, all right, guys, make sure you stick around. Mr. Kevin Blanche is up next. And then tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern, we have Ron with Game On. He's always live Tuesday and Thursday, 8 o'clock. Behind the Woodshed, this week's show with Mr. Hal Anthony. At 10 p.m. Eastern, we have Chuck on Double Cross Radio, and at 11, S.M. Gibson with Anti-Media Radio. All right, guys, make sure you stick around. Have an awesome Thursday.